You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. Two guests this week. First up, my colleague at The Athletic, the senior NBA writer Sam Amick. And we get into Sam's piece, Could LeBron James Actually Retire? Seems unlikely, but the leverage game may have begun. We talk about what a post-LeBron NBA universe might look like as far as content, as far as viewership in the NBA. Talk a little bit about the Nuggets in the NBA Finals. I'm one who believes, maybe against conventional wisdom, that there's going to be more interest in a Nuggets Finals than you might think about. And then finally, just LeBron, as in my opinion, the most successful 21st century athlete, just given that he came up in a social media age. So Sam Amick to start. He is followed by LaChina Robinson, who is a longtime WNBA analyst and does exceptional work when it comes to that sport. We talk about the WNBA's great start with Brittany Griner's return game, massive, massive viewership for that league in relation to what previous season openers have done on ESPN. We talk about the many people who are now covering the league, and both of us have seen an uptick just in terms of content, really a big uptick in the last 12 months and what that means. And then just carving out a career, covering women's basketball as LaChina Robinson has done. If you like these kind of conversations, please leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That is how this podcast continues. And without further ado, let's get Sam to start, and then followed by LaChina coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right. As I said at the top, very pleased to be joined by my colleague at The Athletic, Sam Amick, who is a senior NBA writer. If you're an NBA fan, you have certainly read his work over the years. Sam, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I appreciate you coming on. We're going to do basically a short segment here, and it's going to be very LeBron James specific. Please don't get mad at me. The Nuggets are a great story. All right. I'm not knocking the Nuggets here. It's just Sam wrote a really interesting piece on The Athletic. The headline was, Could LeBron James Actually Retire? Seems unlikely, but the leverage game may have begun. I think, like Sam, I don't expect LeBron to retire at all. But Sam, I bring you in because I'm so fascinated by the post-LeBron world in the NBA and what that might look like viewership-wise, content-wise. He's been such a dominant force in our lives for so long. Very big picture, if you can, and I realize I'm not holding you to this if you're not right, but what do you think like the NBA content world looks like in a post-LeBron James universe?
Richard, thank you for having me. Appreciate you. It was wild to hear him even hint or allude to that post-LeBron universe the other night in that press conference. And like you said, you know, we are talking about 20 years in which this one particular transcendent player has dominated so much of the conversation. In fact, you know, as you've seen, these West Finals encapsulate that perfectly. You've got Nuggets coach Michael Malone almost on a daily basis complaining about the fact that even though his team is, you know, playing at a superior level and doing all kinds of things that deserve to be dominating the conversation, that sure enough, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody. I wrote about LeBron on the night that the Nuggets won the West. What does it look like after LeBron? You know, I don't know what direction to take that conversation. Where my mind goes is it's unclear. There's all kinds of young superstars in the NBA space that are worthy of, you know, of kind of filling that void. Not one guy, as we know with recent headlines and current events, you know, one American-born player that was showing a lot of promise to be a big part of the conversation, John Morant, has been, you know, killing his own brand and his image lately. LeBron is is that unique unicorn of having met the expectations on the court and then built, you know, who he is off the court to such a degree that that there's nobody like him.
You know, like I understand where Michael Malone is coming from, and I also think there's always value in making it an us against the world kind of thing.
Yep.
You know, human beings can focus on two different things at once, right? You can focus on the brilliance of the Nuggets and also like pay attention to the fact that the biggest sports star in American society in the 21st century maybe, you know, has hinted for the first time ever at a retirement thing. Like, to me, like, two things can happen. I know this gets into very much like, you know, NBA Twitter and NBA content, but like, you know, like, we're, it's okay to focus on both because both are significant stories.
It is, although if you hit the rewind button, go back to game one, Nikola Jokic has a fantastic night, and the Lakers were the conversation. They put Rui Hachimura on Jokic for the fourth quarter of that game, and the narrative in a lot of places was, did the Lakers find something? And that is what began Malone's complaints. I will say, and this is the perfect platform because, and I am a loyal listener to the pod, and I'll always love what you do, is from a media standpoint, and I say this only half-kiddingly, like, I have felt like in this particular series that Michael Malone and specifically the folks at ESPN and maybe specifically the Kendrick Perkins of the world, like, they need to get in a room and work out their issues, because what Malone is reacting to, in my opinion, is largely, you know, the commentary from a handful of folks. I gave him a hard time after game one, both in print, so to speak, and in person, and said, you know, Michael, I wrote 1,600 words on Jokic after game one. You know, I think my focus was where you would have wanted it to be, but that's not what he's reacting to.
That's a great, you know what, like, and again, like, this is just the realities of, you know, modern sports media, but so often athletes, coaches, franchises are reacting to a very small sliver of television opinionists where, and I get it, like, I know that's prominent and outsized and usually loud, but there are people like you, like, every day who are sort of in the trenches, like, writing thoughtful, deep stuff. And, like, it's, again, and again, I'm not blaming Michael Malone, who I think is a brilliant coach, but, like, if you're reacting to, like, what somebody said on First Take or, you know, one of ESPN's, like, or Fox Sports One's, like, you know, debate shows, it's such an infinitesimal part of the media, capital, of sports media, right? Capital S, capital M.
Right.
Like, I guess how would I say this, Sam? Michael Malone is smart enough to know that, is what I would say. And you kind of wish that at least the smart people out there kind of recognize that it's a very, very small slice and it's intentionally designed to get you to react or to provoke you into a reaction.
Well, yes, couldn't agree more. I will also say, Richard, you already hit the nail on the head a few moments ago when you talked about the us against the world mentality. Like, that is Michael's personality. That is how he's wired. I even joked with a Nuggets official about the whole column thing. Like, hey, I guess you didn't read the Jokic column, huh? And they laughed and they said, oh, come on. You know, he doesn't care about the positive stuff. Like, he's going to gravitate to the negative stuff because that's what fuels his team. And really, they haven't seen a lot of the national media, myself included, for a lot of the season. So it's had this hilarious vibe of like, all right, we've been waiting 6 months to talk to y'all. You know what I mean? Like, I made one trip to Denver this year, and I'm probably around them a little bit more than most national people. But, you know, they've been, you know, doing their little victory lap here and well-deserved.
All right. So, I tweeted this out, and I believe it to be the case. If the Heat can get past the Celtics, and by the way, I probably shouldn't have been so, like, assured of thinking that was going to be the case at some point. It's, as we tape this, it's 3-1. I still would not expect the Heat to blow a 3-0 lead, but series goes back to Boston. If they win that game, it's 3-2, and it's real interesting, and I hope they win that game because I think just as a sports story, that's interesting. But Sam, I'm one who believes like the Nuggets-Heat NBA Finals is going to do better viewership-wise than maybe conventional wisdom sits. And conventional wisdom says that, like, you know, Miami's never been a great television team. Denver is basically, you know, in the middle of nowhere. It's not Lakers Celtics. The series is going to bomb viewership wise. But I think there's something to be said about Jokic on a national final stage as a multiple time MVP that could get some casual fans interested in addition to the hardcore NBA fans who will watch this. So it's not great in terms of the traditional dynamics for television in terms of like market size or traditional franchises that do well. But I don't know. I have a weird feeling that this is going to do better than expected, particularly if it goes long. I know you're not a quote-unquote sports television writer, but from your NBA perspective, what do you think of that series in terms of national interest?
I mean, I think the league itself, if it does, you know, pop a little more than they anticipated, I think it would be great for them. And this, I say in the context of the LeBron conversation, is that, you know, the league and the fact that it's been, you know, such a intense focus on the stars and the bigger markets for so long, I think it would be healthy for the league if a Denver-Miami series did well in the finals.
Yeah.
And
great.
I think that, again, if you want to have that discussion about the post-LeBron landscape in the NBA, you know, you can have a two-track approach where, of course, you continue to elevate the right superstars, the right young players, and try to fill that void. There's not going to be one person that fills it, but then you cannot lose the connectivity between all those small markets and the mainstream. And it's, you know, that is something where I think the league has been a little bit out of whack for a while. And it does, even beyond the television side, there's this domino effect on the rest of the media industry where, you know, you and I, we just talked offline a little bit about, you know, the data part of our jobs and where you are constantly aware of what stories get read and which ones don't. You know, I can tell you from my little corner of the market that you know, the disparity is vast. It's dispiriting at times because you want to be like, you know, I've heard you reference a journalist with a capital J and follow the right stories and reflect what you should reporting wise. But then you will write about, to be honest, in the past, the Nuggets are one where you write what you feel like is a strong piece about them. And then you go, oh boy, nobody read that thing. You know what I mean? Like that. That imbalance, you know, maybe could be aided by a finals like that. And TV wise, you're right. I don't have great instincts for that aspect of it. But I think it would be great for the league if it did well.
Yeah. And listen, the realities are there are certain people in all our beats that pop, and such will always be the case. You know, the hope is that you do get, you get some stories that maybe were underplayed for a long time that eventually pop. You know, one sort of story in my world, and obviously I have an affinity for it because I covered it, Sports Illustrated, but it's been great to see women's basketball now start to get some really, really big numbers, particularly the women's college game, where for a long time, like if you wrote that or covered that, you know, you might not get the kind of page views that you would get if you wrote about, LeBron or Tom
right.
Brady, et cetera. So I'm with you. I think it would be healthy if that series did well. I think, speaking as a sort of sports television person, I think length would be really, really important. You'd want that series to go 6 or 7 because I think that's when you can get a significant pop in viewership. I want to ask you just one more thing about LeBron. I have this sort of thesis. I don't think it's any genius take by me. But given, Sam, that he came up in an age of social media, in an age of technology, in an age of streaming, in an age of sort of the mass consumption of content, I find him to be the most successful athlete in my lifetime and the most successful athlete in the 21st century because, by and large, he was able to succeed at the absolute highest levels without really being taken down by the all-encompassing sort of like social mediaization that athletes in LeBron's station have to focus. That's independent of the fact that obviously he's one of the two or three greatest players of all time. I can't sort of marvel at his career enough because unlike Michael Jordan, who obviously both of us saw him was a great player, Michael Jordan didn't have to deal with like 1/10 of what LeBron has to deal with in terms of the content play. And I wonder if you've just ever thought of that in terms of LeBron's success amid being what a star athlete means in 2023 versus what a star athlete might have meant in like 1987 or something like
that. Yeah, no question. I mean, it's a completely different ecosystem that both LeBron and Michael, to kind of focus on the two GOATs, what they went through is night and day. And I'm with you on the appreciation for LeBron's career, what he's built, what he's done. What I like about it is that we're not talking about a 20-year love affair between LeBron and the public and the media. That would be, I mean, listen, we're storytellers. Like, that would be boring, right? It's been compelling. A lot of the conflict, a lot of the you know, darker times for LeBron, if you will, nothing incredibly dark, but you know, they were earlier on. They were finding his way in Cleveland, facing criticism. You know, this guy is pretty special, but can he get the job done? The ill-fated finals against the Mavericks. Questions after that, is he the best player in the world? And the Miami decision. You know, I love looking back on it, how, you know, the journey from there to all the way to the press conference the other night has had all these peaks and valleys, but it has ascended. And that's where I think he deserves so much credit, is that it's ascended on the court and off the court. You know, a lot of the stuff he's done all over the world, but specifically in his old Akron community, is just remarkable. And, you know, but he's always going to be, he's himself. He's imperfect. He is open to criticism. The other night, he was very LeBron with his hinting of retirement. And yes, there's maybe some truth to it. Not maybe. I think his mind does go there. But it was also, I mean, wasn't that a classic LeBron moment?
Yeah, leave. It's like a season finale of a great show, and then he leaves, and you got to wait 4 months to figure out what the next episode.
Right, and even more specifically, you know, I made the mistake, and I had to play catch up of leaving that press conference halfway through because it seemed fairly vanilla, and I we talk about the Nuggets. I had tried to go honor the victor and go to the Nuggets side, and as I come back, that press conference with LeBron had just ended. And Richard, you would have loved, because you kind of traffic in this stuff, you would have loved seeing the vibe after the press conference, because all the reporters were buzzing. And, you know, you had a few guys tracking LeBron down, David McMenamin from ESPN, Chris Haynes, were, you know, trying to pursue that LeBron storyline even more. I remember talking to Melissa Rowland from FoxSports.com, and she had asked a question of LeBron that ultimately got the answer in the press conference. And her head was spinning a bit, at least in terms of like, wow, like what just happened? That's kind of the power of LeBron, is that he knows his voice. He sat up there contemplating, what am I going to say? And sometimes he's hit the mark. You know, the other night was fine. Nothing wrong with it. Sometimes he hasn't. You go back to the decision, which he has since admitted that it was botched, you know, going to the Boys and Girls Club outside of New York and things of that nature. But, you know, the guy's reputation is in a very good place. His career is one of a kind, and it has been fun to watch.
Last one for me. Are you still based around the Sacramento area?
I am. Yep.
Now that the Kings obviously are have become very, very good and a real factor, I wonder, like, is there, like, how much value for is it for someone like in your position to live in a city where the team's relevant, as opposed to if the team is not relevant?
It was honestly fun from the human standpoint of, I've spent a lot of years treating the Kings home arena, whether it's Arco Arena or Golden One Center, as my home office, which just, you know, from a regular life standpoint, giving you the ability to not be on the road all the time and to go get your work done in an NBA arena. But I like the game of basketball. I enjoy the game of basketball. And there were so many years where it was kind of a slog to go out to the Kings games, knowing that I'm going to try to always connect with, you know, especially when the Kings, all those years they were bad, like, I'm not talking to the Kings players. I'm not talking to the Kings coaches. I'm going to get the other team. And the game itself was beyond an afterthought. It was kind of an unwelcome part of the program, if that makes sense. Like, the games weren't good. They lost all the time. And this year was so different. It was neat to shift the attention on a lot of nights towards, wow, okay, let me go ahead and write about the Kings. Let me see what they're doing. And as they know, I mean, we talk about stories that pop and choices you make journalistically. You know, my most successful King stories for the past 5 years at The Athletic have all been stories that captured their dysfunction and, you know, the mistakes they had made. This year was different. It was a fun ride to cover. You know, it made the playoffs a little more manageable for me. I got to see my wife and kids a little more than I had in years past. And although I'll be honest, these are first world problems, but the new challenge was filing, you know, staying up, filing a story at 2 or 3 in the morning and realizing that you're not sleeping in a hotel room. You're getting up with your kids at 6:30. So that was a little tough. but no, it was a fun ride.
Sam Amick is a senior NBA writer for The Athletic. Check out his pieces on the site. Follow him on Twitter. The NBA obviously is heading towards his finals, but there's really no offseason anymore for Sam. You know, whether he'll be there for summer league or whether he's figuring out what teams do what with prior to the season in terms of potential trades and certainly coaching hires, Sam will be all over it. Sam, it's great to catch up with you, man, and continued success at The Athletic, and thank you for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Likewise.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
All right. As I said at the top, excited to have this guest. She's been on this podcast before. LaChyna Robinson joined ESPN originally in 2009 as a college basketball analyst and reporter. If you are a women's basketball fan, particularly a WNBA fan, you certainly know who she is and recognize her work. You see her on WNBA coverage, WNBA playoffs, the WNBA draft. For many, many years, she worked in women's college basketball, so you might see her on some Final Four kind of programs. She's the host of the ESPN YouTube show Around the Rim. Also has her own SiriusXM podcast, Huge Fan, which she can talk about. And then finally, she is one of the broadcasters for the Atlanta Dream of the WNBA on Bally's Sports South. And boy, it's like a 5-year exodus to get all your big promotion now, LaChyna. And I am pleased to be joined by LaChyna Robinson, one of the great people in women's basketball. Welcome back to the Sports Media Podcast, LaChyna.
Thanks, Richard. It's always great to be with you. I feel like you and I are part of the pioneer crew of covering women's basketball. You a little more so than me, but it's always great to reconnect.
LaChyna, you're so charming in a way to say, one, I'm older than you, and two, that you're not as you're not as withered as myself. So there you go. But yes, I couldn't remember the city, but I remember seeing LaChyna Robinson at many women's basketball kind of conferences or outings, and she was always grinding away. It's pretty hard not to recognize her. She's like a striking 6'3", 6'4" woman, and so it's very cool to see her continuing to succeed on now major platforms like ESPN's WNBA coverage. All right, let's get into it a little bit. So Brittany Griner's return game, which by the way tipped at 11:20 or so Eastern time, draws the highest opening weekend game for ESPN in the history of the league. There obviously was interest in Griner, I think, beyond just WNBA fans, LaChyna. But again, this continues these, to me, data points of Iowa LSU, nearly 10 million viewers for the Women's College Basketball Championship Final. The Final Four, including South Carolina, et cetera, was looking at over 5 million. WNBA was up this year. WNBA gets a big pop in terms of their opening weekend. Very big picture. Again, I keep thinking we're getting all these now viewership data points to show that the growth of interest in women's basketball is real and sustained and defining. How do you see it?
I see it the same way. It's skyrocketing. And for those of us that have covered this sport for a long time, it's exciting, quite honestly, Richard. I feel like we're in a time where over the last couple of years, we're always getting these emails of, hey, we had the most watched game since 2004, or this is the most watched draft, or, our viewership has gone up 30-something percent, like we're getting those notifications all the time. And it's like, wow, like what we believed about this sport is actually starting to show in the data points. And you know how important that is, not only for getting more viewership windows, more primetime opportunities, but also in terms of investments. You know, when you think about wanting to get sponsors to grow even what we have happening now in our sport, they want to see the numbers. They want to see that the people are there. They want to see that the attendance is up and all the metrics are moving in the right direction to indicate that women's basketball is a worthy investment. It's not a charity. This is a place where money can be made, where there's revenue opportunity. And, you know, it's just been so awesome to watch the spike, but also the number of people who are now clamoring to be a part of this sport. I mean, you and I, there's been many Final Fours where, you know, some aspects of it, not the games itself, but were undercovered or stories that weren't being told along the way. And now we see just a tremendous amount of interest in not only watching and consuming women's basketball, but also working with this sport in terms of the media coverage and in various aspects.
This would be more anecdotal. When you know, you're someone who really, really prepares, you read a lot. You have knowledge, obviously, of every team in the league. From my own place, like, I know The Athletic has expanded when it comes to women's basketball coverage, and there are just, in terms of sheer numbers, more stories on the WNBA. When you're doing your research, LaChina, or even, like, if you're doing something with ESPN and they probably provide you with, like, some great research, like, are you seeing more, like, coverage from daily newspapers or from independent writers and bloggers? Because anecdotally, it feels like there's more, but I think you'd have a better sense of it than me.
There's definitely an uptick, and there's a direct correlation in my mind between the growth in the grassroots media aspect of women's basketball and what we're seeing overall in this sport. And I thought about this, like, just even coming into our conversation, and a lot of it starts with the importance of social media when it comes to women's sports in general, but in particular women's basketball, and that it's been a space. Twitter has been a place for women's basketball fans to come for and learn more about the sport and to follow their favorite player and to get reminders that there's a game coming on. Like, you're not going to see it on a billboard. You may not see it on a commercial every 5 seconds, but someone on Twitter is going to be talking about women's basketball, someone on these platforms. So it starts with that. It's also streaming. So technology and social media have had a lot to do with it. But I sat down to think about what we did not have when it came to women's basketball coverage that we have now. And I feel like our record keeping, our history, the storytelling has come such a long way, because if it wasn't Mel Greenberg or M.A. Vopel or Doug Feinberg or Shill Coward at the event, there were so many things happening around this sport that you would not know. And so it kind of started with that group. But what we've seen over time is, okay, the Hoop feed and how we were all getting information there, or Swish Appeal kind of, I feel like, has been there for a while in covering women's basketball. But then now we're digging into the numbers. So you have like Her Hoop Stats and Across the Timeline, a great site run by Aaron runs Her Hoop Stats, and Curtis runs Across the Timeline. And they're giving, you know, real time salary cap information that we used to not have. You know, they're giving the historical context around performances on a nightly basis in our sport. And then you look at the fact that we did not have newsbreakers in terms of free agency signing. So you've got Christina Williams and Rachel Galligan, and I'm going to leave a whole lot of people out, but you'll understand what I'm trying to say here. But to your point, there's now beat writers for teams, Miles Ehrlich, who covers the Liberty, or Dorothy Gentry in Dallas, or Kareem Copeland, who covers, you know, the Washington Mystics. There's a W Slam now. There was no women's basketball slam 10 years ago, you know, so Camille started that. And you've got, you know, Ari Chambers at Highlighters, Winsider, The Next with Howard Megdal's group. I mean, these are all entities that have now come along and come together and have brought significant coverage to this sport that didn't exist. And again, I know I'm leaving a lot of people out. You mentioned there's just women's sports. Like, can you imagine, like, if we really did a study on where women's basketball media has gone in the last, I would even say 7 or 8 years, I mean, it's skyrocketed. And so that has added to the fandom, because now fans can stay in a know. They have more storytelling, more information. They understand more about how this league works and the players. And the players have done a great job, too, in building their their brands via social media. They're taking control of that through their social handles. So we're learning more about them. So it's just this perfect storm, in addition to, you know, ESPN giving more more shine in every way, countdown shows, you know, adding our all-star game this year to primetime. I mean, it takes a lot of things, Richard, but you get what I'm saying. This is exciting for me.
I do.
This is exciting.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm really glad you made, first of all, you would absolutely have a better name recognition of all the people you mentioned. I've certainly heard of them all, but some of the names you mentioned, actually not some, all of the names you mentioned are the ones who are really grinding day to day in different kinds of ways to bring content. And you're so right, whether it's like a newsbreaker analysis, whether it's like the financials now, even like what's interesting now is you've seen people move from one place to another. I'll give you like a perfect example, just because I happen to know, because it was my place. Hannah Withiam is now the senior managing editor of just women's sports, has a major like editorial role there at the Hillary Rosen's place. You know, she used to work at The Athletic. Now she moves over, has like more of a senior management position, can bring people over. You mentioned Rachel Galligan. I know that Lindsay D'Arcangelo works, does a lot of stuff for Just Women's Sports as well. So that's like how this stuff, you know, Howard Magdalene mentioned, is a total pioneer in this stuff. That's how this stuff is growing. And I'm glad you shouted them out, because like, you're right. Once upon a time, it's so interesting, like that you mentioned, like Doug Feinberg of the AP and Mel Greenberg's pretty famous, MA Vopal of ESPN. But you're like, that was the conduit of an S, like someone like Sports Illustrated, like we'd pop in just for the finals. Like, you know, we wouldn't be doing it on a day-to-day basis. So I'm glad you mentioned all those people. Because the media element has changed. It gets me into my next question for you. I just covered the WNBA game in Toronto, which was a sellout, which by all indications from talking to people in the league was an absolute home run. I think they were even surprised at the turnout and interest. When you look around, what markets do you think the league can come in and be a success? The one thing you don't want to do is go into a market and for things not to work. But are there a couple of cities that you think, if they expand in the next year or so, like everything is there, including the media coverage?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't know that I've even thought about expansion in terms of the media coverage. But you know what's interesting is you would think that markets where there is an NBA team, that would be helpful, but I don't know. We'd have to go back and look at the research. I don't know that that's been a conduit in terms of any success, because
it feels like the Bay Area. Though,
I was
going to
say, I was going to say. So, but and I'm speaking in terms of like what happened with the Sacramento Monarchs folding, which, you know, the Monarchs, the Kings haven't had a great deal of success, or like the Houston Rockets with the Comets. Like those are situations that I think are different, but yes, I will. I think Toronto, number one, they totally earned it. They showed us what they're capable of. Merchandise show selling out, viewership, sellout venue. And then the Bay, you know, I mean, you would have to really look at the energy in that place around women's basketball. I think when you start to think about the price point of what it probably takes to run a team in that market, that's, I'm sure, where things get a little bit complicated, but there's also more capital there, if you will, just because, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, there's a lot of things there existing, a lot of big time investors, and obviously the Warriors are doing a lot of things right. And so, yeah, that would be another place. I think of it a little bit more in terms of like, where is women's basketball supported? Because I still have this dream of there being this full circle support from college women all the way around to the pros. So we have the Atlanta Dream in the Southeast, but I kind of feel like we can still have another team in this market. When you look at the viewership for women's basketball, Louisville is always there. Knoxville is always there. I've always selfishly wanted the Charlotte Sting to come back because that was where I watched my first WNBA game. So I think the Southeast, with where the SEC is moving and trending in women's basketball and the history of the ACC, I think this area could afford another team.
What about Nashville? Do you think that would be what kind of city? I mean, it's fairly close to Knoxville, but not, yeah, you know, not exactly next door, but that would seem, you know, that's an SEC city. A lot of people are moving there.
I like Nashville.
A lot of culture, a lot of arts.
I actually attended some SEC tournaments and a Final Four, I'm pretty sure, in Nashville that were out of this world. I think Nashville is just a perfect sports city in general. So yeah, I think that's in close enough proximity even for fans to come from Knoxville and for them to build some synergy there. But those are some of my initial thoughts, but I'm sure there's so many other things that Commissioner Kathy Engelbert is looking at. Folks want a team in Philly. They want, you know, I mean, the fans, of course, are wanting.
Portland is another one where the people want.
Yeah, Portland's another one. So it's an ongoing conversation, but I do think it needs to happen sooner rather than later.
I agree. You are somebody who for many, many years has had to, and you're still doing it, you had to sort of have multiple jobs in order to forge your career in women's basketball coverage. You know, as I mentioned earlier at the top, you're still working for ESPN, you're working for Bally's, you have your SiriusXM podcast. Have you found in 2023, is the market doable better for someone like you who wants to have a career in women's basketball? I think if we had this conversation, honestly, in like 2012 or 2010, honestly, maybe like you're the only one who could have pulled. Like you have like a, you know, you're able to pay your mortgage within the women's basketball media ecosystem. It does feel that dream for a lot of people is a little better today. I'm not still saying you got to struggle. I'm not saying you're going to be a millionaire or anything, but it does feel like there's more entities now to have that kind of career. You're really a pioneer in this. Where do you see the landscape in 2023?
It's better in terms of the entry opportunities, but it's still not where it needs to be when it comes to pay scale. And we can still use even more opportunities. But I think back to when I started, I was probably doing 4 or 5 games a week. And keeping in mind, I was working for the Big Ten Network and Fox and CBS Sports and doing some ESPN and, you know, across the board just to stay afloat, because no one, either the network didn't have enough women's basketball to bring me in full time, or they weren't going to pay me enough to go, you know, to have a full time deal with one network. Like I've worked for so many different, oh God, it's crazy. Like that's not even half the list. Worked for Turner for a while. So it's gotten better in that I am living a dream right now in being able to just focus on the WNBA. I never saw this happening. Now, I loved my 15 years in covering college women's basketball, but it was a grind. Like I said, 4 or 5 games a week of college women. That wasn't my WNBA schedule, but of college women's basketball is a lot. And so now we're at a point where there's more WNBA content. And honestly, I've bet on this league and saying, I'm just going to put my time into the W, become an expert in this space. And I see more media companies getting on board. I really see that, Richard. And I hope it happens so that there's more for everyone, because I know a lot of really hardworking people who love this sport and have full-time jobs and are doing this on the side for little to nothing. I mean, I think about Around the Rim podcast, for example, where Tarika and I were doing this out of our pockets. Many people don't realize we're in year 8. We didn't get paid to do this podcast. We were doing it because we loved it. And we put our own money into the marketing and to all of those other things. But that's because we knew how important these conversations were. So I feel fortunate to be in the position that I am in, but God knows I am one of a few. And I just want to take this opportunity to acknowledge the people that I know aren't getting paid for their blood, sweat, and tears the way they should, and to shame some of the media entities that refuse to open the doors and the entry opportunities and the coverage for women's basketball and for the WNBA, because there are a lot of really, really talented people who should be getting paid a lot of money for what they do.
Have you been able to do this without an agent, or have you used an agent when it comes to all the multiple television things that you've done?
So I have been my own agent for a majority of my career. I've been in this about 16 years. And I would say about 13 of those were without an agent. I did sign with Nicole Lynn back in 2020, I believe, might have been 2019. So I have had an agent, but for a long time, Richard, no one was interested. I talked to several agents about my interest in women's basketball. And because we don't get paid as much as other sports, there just wasn't that 10% was not interesting for many of these agents. They weren't lining up outside my doors. Also, when it came to women's basketball, many agents didn't even understand how our sport worked when it came to the broadcasting side. It was like, okay, well, who do I contact? I knew all the people to contact. Like I could be my own agent because these guys just had no interest. The money wasn't there. And so it was kind of like, eh, you know, if you ever decide to start doing NBA, call us. But I'm grateful for Nicole and that, no, she's not a broadcasting agent, but she is brilliant when it comes to contract negotiations. She is a complete student in this space and has jumped on and learned as much as she could in this time that she and I have been working together. And obviously I now have, she's signed with Clutch and with UTA since we've been working together, but we were working together prior to that. So now I am privy to some of the luxury of a larger agency, but this is new. This is really new.
Yeah. By the way, the people who don't know Nicole Lynn, I'll just name one of her clients for you. He's a player on the Philadelphia Eagles named Jalen Hurts, yeah, who signed a $255 million contract. Yeah. So Nicole Lynn basically has one of the singular great clients in sports right now. And yeah. I think I'm doing this off the top of my head. I'm fairly certain that's the highest contract in the history of the National Football League.
Oh, 100%. And I'll say this right now, Richard. It's funny. Nicole always tells the story of her DMing Jalen, and that's kind of how they connected for her to become their agent. I DM'd her. And again, this was prior to Clutch, prior
shoot
to
your,
Jalen.
Shoot your shot.
I DM'd her and said, if you ever start taking broadcast clients, please call me. Like, I just saw so much alignment with who she is. And I've always wanted a Black woman also as a representative. And so this was like rare air we were in. And here it is. Nicole's probably 10 years younger than I am, Richard. But when I tell you, she's brilliant. Obviously, you see how she's handled Jalen and so many of her other clients. I think she's the first Black woman to have an NFL player drafted in the top three in the draft. So and to represent now a quarterback in the Super Bowl. So I got very lucky.
Yeah, that's awesome. The one thing that I found in dealing with the many agents that I've talked to, honestly, LaChyna, it's one, like, the best ones, like, do they believe in their client, like, really believe in them, not just, like, see them as a paycheck. And the other thing, and this is why I'm sure Nicole is phenomenal at what she does, what the people do, whether it's football, whether it's basketball, in your case, if it's broadcasting, mm-hmm, is kind of irrelevant. The larger point is, if the agent can understand sort of the marketplace, see a couple steps ahead, yes, in terms of what's out there. Like, that's the brilliance of it. It's you can learn or research at least enough, like, what the marketplace is, but you really just have to believe in your client and you have to sort of have a vision as to what they can do.
Very true. Because
or a shared vision. And that's why Nicole could represent any, I mean, Nicole, I guarantee, could represent, maybe she does, like, actors, actresses, painters, artists. It's the same process, essentially.
Absolutely. And there is clearly not as much incentive in representing me as there is Jalen
versus Jalen Hurts,
right,
of course.
But to your point, she sees a lot in me. She always has believed in me. There are certain types of clients that are near and dear to her. Like, she wants to help to build the women's sports space. She wants to help to build me as a woman of color in this space. So there are other motivations to that. But she has been phenomenal, like, literally career changing for me.
Yeah, I always, you know, it's interesting, like, this will be the last one on this, like, little point. I always it always tells me something about certain agents if their original clients are with them when said agent has gotten like massive and big and is representing like the, you know, the Kirk Herbstreets of the world or, you know, whoever, or Al Michaels. Like that always tells me something because that tells me then you're not necessarily about money.
Yeah.
You're actually about people. And so, and so that's cool to see. Cause you're, I mean, let's just be blunt. Like the, what you're making for Nicole yeah. compared to like what Jalen Hurts is making, like
she spends on her pedicures. That's basically what you get from.
So it's not really the point. The point is believing in people. Yeah.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived and feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
All right, before you get out of here, what is your SiriusXM podcast that you're doing? Huge fan.
Yeah, it's a really cool podcast called Huge Fan. And what we do is we basically interview celebrities, musicians, entertainers, actors, artists on their favorite sports teams. So we get the perspective of fandom from Ashley Judd, from Michael Bublé, from you know, just so many different celebrities. And it's honestly one of the most fascinating things I've ever done. It's amazing to hear these celebrities talk about their fandom, how far it goes back in their family lineage, the things they've done to make a playoff game, canceling concerts. It is just, it's been one of the most fun things I've ever done. So it's really cool if folks get a chance to listen.
Here, before we get out of here, actually, I do have one more for you. I know we've had super teams before, like in some ways, in both women's college basketball and the WNBA. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a believer that I think it's good for the sport. One, it gets people interested because there's a lot of stars on one team. And two, I think it incentivizes other teams, mm-hmm. whether it's college teams or pro teams, to get better. We saw that with UConn. I think if you talk to the coaches, and I know you did over the years, like they would tell you that like Oriyama's like championships made them better, made them recruit better, made them get better facilities. And now look at the sport, you know,
yep.
Dawn Staley's like won a couple championships. Obviously we saw Kim Mulkey at LSU. So how do you feel, you know, there's right now there's really sort of quote unquote two super teams in the WNBA. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win, but I think this is great for the league because I think like as a casual basketball fan, like if the Aces are on, I just think like you might want to check that out because you recognize four of like the five starting players.
Yeah, I am enjoying the super team narrative. To your point, there have been a lot of stacked teams over time, but the way these teams have come together is a reflection of one, the new CBA, you know, that came across in 2020, which is taking the number of coring opportunities away from teams for star players is more money to go around. And so we're seeing just like historical movement. And with that, this year in particular came two MVPs going to New York with Jonquel Jones and Breanna Stewart, Candace Parker on the move to Vegas. And it's great because rivalries is what builds sports leagues. You know, it was Lakers versus Celtics on the NBA side. Like this is something that fans are intrigued by and they can sink their teeth into. But the other interesting thing it is doing, Richard, to your point, it's raising the bar. Because if you look at those two organizations in particular in Vegas and New York, their owners have come into this league and have set the bar when it comes to facilities, to advocating publicly for things like charter flights. Mark Davis, Joe Tsai, You know, they have said we have the resources and we will spend it on these players, you know, and we will push for the CBA to allow us to do what needs to be done to treat these players in the right way. So what happens then? These markets become magnets. And it is wake up time for everyone else, all the rest of the owners in this league, to say top talent is going to go where the investment is being made. Candace Parker, who was in what, year 16, 17, somewhere around there, said, "This is the first time I've had my own locker." She's a two-time MVP, two-time champion, and Vegas has a facility where for the first time, she has her own locker, where she doesn't have to take her stuff when she leaves and she can, you know, and so all of those things are important to the super team conversation. And it's been fun from a media standpoint.
All right. Check out her work. LaChyna Robinson, you can find on various ESPN platforms talking about the WNBA. In terms of specifics, obviously, you can catch her on WNBA coverage. She is the host of ESPN YouTube's Around the Rim. Catch her if you happen to have this or you're living in the Southeast on Bally Sports South doing Atlanta Dream Games. And then obviously she mentioned her SiriusXM podcast. Huge fan. Listen, LaChyna, it's always great to catch up with you. I cannot tell you how happy I am for your success. It's great to see on major platforms. And it's really a great story of just somebody, like, in terms of meritocracy, sort of grinding, working really hard, and then getting rewarded with some prestige spots. So thank you for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast, and I will absolutely have you back, maybe around the time we get the WNBA Finals.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate your kind words, and it's for people like you who were covering the sport before I was that have opened the door for this for me. So thank you so much.
All right, once again, calling me old, LaChyna, but I'm going to let it go. Thank you.
In a good way. In a good way.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Sam Amick and LaChyna Robinson for their time and their insights. Head to the archives page. There should be some stuff you like. Previous one before this, Rolling Stone's chief television critic Alan Sepinwall on writing about Succession, nailing series finals, and the Star Wars universe. And Brian Curtis and Ben Strauss come on to talk about Pat McAfee's move to ESPN. Mark Shapiro, CEO and president of Endeavor, the Hollywood entertainment and sports colossus. Peter King was on this podcast not too long ago. Daniel Jeremiah, Tim Layden, and Dana O'Neill on horse racing. Again, head to the archives. There should be some stuff that fits for you. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thanks to everybody at Cadence 13 and Odyssey for their support. And thank you most of all for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk. No. You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, "Oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates." And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.